How do you balance between running a BookTube channel and being a successful self-published author? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of Storyline Sessions podcast. In this one, I'm joined by the author of the exciting ancient Egypt-inspired fantasy novel Harbinger of Justice, as well as a dedicated BookTuber, Andrew Watson. He shared the story of his starts in the community, insights into his writing process, key takeaways from his book launch, as well as many other useful and interesting topics. I'm sure you'll enjoy this one, so grab a coffee or a beer, get settled, and let's get into another episode of Storyline Sessions with Andrew Watson. Enjoy! Hi Andrew, welcome to Storyline Sessions, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for getting back to me. I'm really excited to talk to you. And maybe we can pick up from your latest video. I mean, at least at the time of the recording, the spooky sessions, the spooky talks, the spooky stories. You've assembled quite a cast of YouTubers, BookTubers, and authors who were talking about their recommendations for the season. And it was interesting to me because, you know, you're mostly talking about fantasy. You gather some stuff that are maybe touching upon other genres, but fantasy is the key point. And it was kind of surprising to me to see you dabble into some spooky stuff for the season. So what's your connection to horror? How are you, observing this season? And how do you think it ties into fantasy and the stuff that you do?
For sure, yeah. That was part of the reason why I made it like a big collaboration video, is because I've not read a lot of horror books or anything like that. And I have done a couple of collaborations with some of the people in the video, so I thought this is the perfect time to do my collaboration video and work with some others because get recommendations for the fall season. Because I'm not really a big seasonal reader, but there is something about fall that just makes you want to read certain types of books. I usually gravitate more towards darker books or something like that rather than spooky horror books, so I've not read that many, but I did really enjoy Stephen King's It. And I do want to read more of Stephen King. So that's partly why it was a big collaboration, because I wanted to just get other people's opinions to add to my TBR for this month as well.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see how some people took it. Like, we got some basically almost fully fantasy recommendations with some dark undertones for it, and some people went fully horror, so it was also interesting to see. And I was thinking about like how some subgenres of fantasy do tie into that kind of stuff. Grimdark is kind of there. I mean, even your work, we'll touch upon it quite a bit later on, but like, you do have some darker topics in it, even though they're not front and center, they are certainly there, so it's interesting to see as well. What I wanted to also touch upon is your presence on YouTube and the things you've done on BookTube as an author on one side, but a successful YouTube creator on another. How did it begin? Did you see it as a way to build a community for your writing? Did you want to share your thoughts on books and by chance you decided to keep it tied in with your writing? Or because, you know, this is really a great community. A lot of people are supportive and the people you had on were also great. And it's interesting to see how a lot of writers do tend to create their own communities in this way while also keeping their passion neatly connected to it. So I'm interested to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, for sure. To be fair, I think I'm a weird case because I kind of fell into YouTube. It just kind of made sense because I've always been into filmmaking and shooting videos long before I was even reading. And I got back in reading about 2020 and then picked up when pandemic and everybody was inside. And at the end of 2020, I made an Instagram account, and it was just to communicate with people and interact with people and talk about books. I'd started following a couple people, and I was watching BookTube at that point, but I just really wanted to talk to people about books. So I made the Instagram account because it's not as full on as YouTube, because at the start, I didn't put my face online when I was making the Instagram account. So then I was talking to people, and I really enjoyed the community aspect to it. And it wasn't until I saw Johan, Library of Viking, he made the jump from Instagram to YouTube. And I was like, why am I not doing that? It makes so much sense. Because I love filmmaking and shooting videos, and I have all the gears, and I have a degree in digital media. So I had a lot of the skill set already for creating videos, editing videos, and things like that. I just hadn't done much talking to the camera stuff. That isn't something I'd ever done before. So that was kind of like that seems quite awkward. I'm not sure how I feel about that. So even after I saw Johan do it and I was like, oh, I want to do that, I think I still put it off for about a year. And then I saw people talking about a certain editing footage called DaVinci Resolve, and I saw you could get it for free. So I was like, okay, I'll download it, give it a go. I like staying on top of editing and building on my skills. So I downloaded it, I was testing it, and I was like, right, I need a video to edit. I can't just, you know, play about with the software. So like, right, this is it. I'm just going to commit. I'm going to make like one or two videos, and if they flop or no one cares and I don't have fun, then I'm just going to never do it again. It's just to test out the software. And then I put up the first video and it did really, really well, and I had a lot of fun doing it. So I was like, right, I'll just, you know, keep doing one or two. And then I just really fell in love with filmmaking and getting to film videos. That was always a problem for me, was I loved filmmaking, but I never knew what to film. That was part of the reasons why I kind of moved away from it and I was doing more photography stuff. So the fact that I have things to shoot and things to talk about, it made so much sense to hop over. But yeah, it's huge for writers to have like a big social media presence and things like that. So I kind of fell into it and it was just lucky, but it's played a huge part in how my book's done. I'm terrible at marketing. No idea what I'm doing. I've had several people ask me and I'm like, I think most of them have just come through because they've seen me online on Instagram and YouTube and things like that. So yeah, I just kind of fell into it and it worked and I really enjoy it now. So I've committed.
Yeah, and I think that also the thing that you mentioned, that your background is in filmmaking, photography, I think it quite shows, because, you know, it's quite a distinct style that's not usually seen in like book reviews, book talks, because you have the B-rolls, you have some like mixing of the formats, backgrounds, and I think that like is more suitable to, let's not say suitable, but more frequent in other types of videos. And that's what one of the things that caught my eye as well. But it's interesting that you mentioned that you didn't know what to shoot. Didn't you, like, as a storyteller, as somebody who writes, didn't you, like, want to create some stories in that medium? Or it never, like, seemed like a way you want to express yourself?
Yeah, no, I used to actually film more, like, short film stuff with friends and stuff when we were in high school, and then university, we all kind of split ways and didn't have the same amount of free time. So we didn't have the same, you know, we can't all get together every weekend and shoot and have fun. So it just kind of fell away then. I do really like telling stories through visual mediums as well. It's just a lot harder doing it just yourself. And I like big stories and fancy and, you know, lots of characters and lots of things happening. And that's really tough to do by yourself. And just, yeah, I'm not an actor. I'm definitely not an actor, shocking actor. One of my friends got me to be a part of his short film and it was not good, because, well, my acting was not good. It was horrific. So being able to, that was one of the reasons why I got back into writing as well, is because I love storytelling and things like that. And being able to write is just, you can do whatever. The amount of freedom in writing that you don't have by creating something visually, because you don't need to worry about making it look realistic or having lots of people involved. You can just create these worlds and these characters and these stories just yourself. It's just so accessible. All you need is a pen and paper, really. I mean, it's easier on a computer with typing, but pen and paper, that's all you really need to do that. Whereas visual stuff is a lot more difficult, especially for fancy and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, like what you mentioned, doing it yourself, the freedom that you get, I guess that's one of the main reasons you went the self-publishing route. Yeah, because as we've seen with your book, Harbinger of Justice, it's been a self-published trip. You do have like collaborations for distribution, if I'm not mistaken, but it's basically a one-man show. So could you tell us a bit about your trip with that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I actually didn't know anything about self-publishing until I got into the community on Instagram. It wasn't, well, I had a vague idea that people could publish their own books, but I didn't really know anything about it until I got an Instagram page and I saw this huge community. And a lot of people do talk about the stigma of self-publishing, and there is that, but I have seen way more support for indie and self-publishing than I have, you know, stigma around it or hate towards it. It's very rare now. Well, I've I don't know if it's just the circles I'm in, but I don't see a lot of hate towards self-publishing. And at the time, I did actually write a sci-fi book. It was more for fun. In 2020 till about the end of 2021, and I just did it for fun, and I didn't outline anything, and I had no idea what I was doing, and I wrote it, and it just wasn't what I wanted it to be. So instead of continuing to work on it, I just scrapped the whole idea, and I was like, right, I want to write a fantasy book. I read more fantasy. It makes sense to write fantasy. I'm not sure why I went down the sci-fi route, but I did. But I moved over to fantasy eventually, and I thought, right, that's when I started looking into publishing traditionally or self-publishing. One of the things that I really, there's a ton of videos and stuff comparing the two, and there's so many pros and cons to both, but one of the things that really made me lean towards self-publishing is, even with traditional publishing, you're kind of doing all the marketing yourself. The upside to traditional for me is, you know, the idea of getting picked up by a publisher, getting the publisher to do these things for you, and also the huge marketing budgets and things behind it. But the more you look into it, traditional published authors don't get a huge marketing budget. You get maybe so many A-listers, or whatever you want to call them, a year, and it's very few. And I think even just getting published by a publisher is really difficult. So to become like one of their big releases for that year is so tough. So even the smaller traditionally published authors still need to do the marketing and things like that themselves. The really big upside is that they pay all the upfront costs, so you don't need to hire editors or artists or anything like that. The publishers will handle that. So that's one of the big upsides to traditional publishing. The other one I really like is being in bookshops. When you write a book, you want to see your book in a bookshop. I mean, that's just cool.
How did that feel when you saw it for the first time in a bookstore?
I've not yet, actually. I've not seen a bookstore yet. Yeah, no. I've been, a couple bookstore managers and people have been in contact. I'm hoping one day that would be really cool. But I've not yet seen one in a bookstore. So that's the downside to self-publishing, is you do need to have this connection to the person who deals with the stock, particularly with bigger bookstores. Because indie bookstores are a lot more, they accept more indies, obviously. And a lot of them, but they just reach out to the people they know quite often, or books that they've seen about that are doing really, really well. So it does make it really difficult to get in bookstores for indie and self-published authors. But the other thing that really may push me into self-publishing was the amount of time it takes to get into traditional, because you need to, you know, finish the book, and then there's querying for agents. You never know if you're going to actually get an agent, because it's such a difficult thing to do. I know tons of talented writers that have just been looking and looking for agents and just had no luck for years and years and years. And their work's excellent. A lot of them do sometimes go into self-publishing after that, and their books are really well received. So it's not always the product. A lot of the time it's if you find the right person, or even the right person at the right time. And the amount of time it would take to get an agent, and then the agent has to, you know, sign on with the publisher. And then I was like, well, the chances of even becoming one of the ones that gets the big marketing budgets is so small. I just was like, right, I'm just going to self-publish this. I don't know how. I'm not actually trained in English. I do know English. That's not what I mean by that. I do, in fact, know the English language. But I don't have any, like, I didn't do any creative writing in university or anything like that. So I thought, I'm going to hire like a really good editor and things like that. But you never know if your book's going to resonate with people. So I was like, I'm just going to self-publish this. And if it flops, then I still had a good time writing it. Because in the end, that's what I really liked, was writing the book itself. So I just decided self-publishing just makes more sense for me personally. And while I was writing it, I was getting really into the community aspects and watching a lot of author interviews and lives and things like that. And a lot of them talked about certain editors and artists. And then I was writing this book, and I hadn't even had the first draft done. I was like, right, I need to get Sarah Chorn, who did eventually edit the book, to be my editor. She seems awesome and really knowledgeable and just really supportive of her authors. So I was like, right, it'd be really cool if I could get her to edit the book. And also, I watched an interview with Jed Hearn's what was the name of the podcast? It's not actually live anymore. Wizards, Warriors, and Words. It's not live anymore, but they still have like 100 plus episodes on Jed's channel. And he had Felix Ortiz on, who is the artist of my book as well. And he talked a bit about it, and I see his work everywhere. If you're in the indie space, the name Felix Ortiz comes up all the time because his covers are stunning. I was like, how cool would it be to get him to do my cover? So I was writing it, enjoying writing it, and then I was like, it'd be really cool to work with these two people. It made so much sense to go through the self-publishing route for me.
Yeah, and as we've seen and as we've yet to see, hopefully it's really panned out great for you. I mean, in a short amount of time since the first book was published, you've gotten some recognition that, like, you've been in the spotlight recently, and you got some fan art, even like stuff that's happening. And as you mentioned, you got those people, you talked about the support you could get from trad publishers getting you editors or artists, and you've got people who you wanted to work with on your first book. So I can imagine that's great. But with the process, like working with the editor independently and with the artist for your cover, how did that look like? Did you come upon some things that you didn't expect? How did the process look like? What was the most maybe surprising thing for you?
Yeah, for sure. So working with the editor was really straightforward. It was one of the things that Sarah likes to do, and one of the reasons why I went with her, is she does this thing called a sample edit. And she says a lot of editors should do this, where you send the first, I think it's 10 pages, 5 pages, something like that, and she edits it and sends it back free of charge. But it's just to see if, one, she thinks your work's ready, two, to see if she is into that sort of style, and three, to see if the author likes the editing style as well. Because she has put up some horror stories on Twitter of people who just think their book is absolutely perfect when they go to an editor. It's like, why are you going to an editor if you think your book's perfect? But some people do end up like that. So I really like that she did this sample edit, and I got back her feedback, and it was all really interesting things. And I really learned a lot by working with her, which is one of the things that I say to a lot of indie authors. Some of them don't get like editors at all, and some of them just, you know, get someone they know to do it. And this is like the two things that I would tell all indie authors to spend money on is the editor and the cover. Because the cover sells your book, but the editor makes people want to read the book. And people want to read the sequel. So, and especially with debuts, I learned so much by working with Sarah. She was amazing to work with, and we did actually have some back and forth about some parts of the book, just, you know, bounced ideas off each other to fix certain things that we needed in the story. And she's an amazing line editor. She picks up all the sentence structure things that needed smoothed out. And I just learned so much by working with her. It was fantastic for that. In fact, at the end of the book, I ended up adding in a couple chapters. I can't remember how many now. I added in a couple new chapters just because we thought this certain part of the story needed fleshed out, and that was fine. And even Sarah commented saying, oh, you know, I'm really impressed how the prose is in these new chapters. And I was like, that's just because I've learned so much by working through your edits for the rest of the book. It's invaluable to have an editor like that that really knows what she's talking about. And I learned so much from it. And as for Felix, I saw him in the interview. One of the things he said was he really likes having some creative control. Because, you know, some authors will go to artists with a fully fleshed, sketched out idea saying, this is exactly what I want for the cover. Whereas I had no idea what I wanted for the cover. Usually I'm quite visual and I would have a cover or something like that in my head, but for this I just didn't. I had no idea what I wanted. So that's one of the reasons why I went to Felix, because he likes the creative control, and the amount of amazing covers he's put out, I like putting that trust in him, because I know that he will make it look good. He knows what will make an enticing cover. So I will have worked with him because he just knew what he was talking about and I didn't.
Yeah, there are a couple of things there I'd like to go back to, but first of all, the cover. I think that's really something that's really amazing. Your cover is awesome, and I really do like his work. He really is a standout, as some people do speak about cover artists and them maybe not being the focus on a lot of books they work on, and a lot of people don't even know a single artist who they can't list a single artist who does covers. And I think that's really something that's really important. And when you think about the attention that you give to art, not just for your work, but on your Instagram, you put a lot of spotlight on things that surround the books, the artwork, the maps, stuff like that. And I do think that's really important. And what do you think about the current trends? Like you've talked a bit on your channel about the trends of especially high fantasy and maybe the stripped down approach. What do you think about the books maybe looking a bit same?
Yeah. Traditional fantasy covers at the moment seem to be very simpler in design. They go for a lot more symbolic and lots of sigils and emblems and very, not straightforward designs, but just more minimalist designs. Whereas one of the things that I really like about fantasy is the like full illustration art, like the sort of golden age, like the early Wheel of the first Wheel of Time covers, things like that. It just screams fantasy.
Maybe we can go back to the maps, because sure. I think that's interesting that you have basically a spotlight for maps on your Instagram profile, and that's something that's amazing to me. And I think that not a lot of modern artists, and maybe more to say modern authors, put maps in their work, and I think that that's something that's really missing in the modern fantasy.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's funny because I'm not a huge map checker. I don't check the map a ton. So I didn't think that there was a huge part to maps in fantasy books until I became part of the community. And I saw how many other people love talking about maps and having their maps in their books. I was like, oh man, I'm going to need a map for my book. Just because I saw how many people love maps. So I thought, right, I'm going to need to get a map for my book. But it's funny, as soon as you get immersed in the community and in just the community as a whole, you get really into seeing like the art and the maps and things like that. All this added stuff is just really fun to check and see. So I've actually really grown to like maps now. And I worked with a cartographer from mine, and he was amazing to work with. He was really good, and the map turned out great. And I now I'm obsessed with maps. It's great.
Getting back to the community part, I've glossed over some things that are really important. Like, how's your impression of the reception of your book so far? And I mentioned a bit of the things like that happened along the way, but could you maybe point out some key moments for you in the past couple of months?
Yeah, it's only been out for a couple, 3 months, 4 months now, something like that. But I'm amazed by the response so far. The thing is, not a lot of people talk about numbers or things like that, so you kind of go into this having no idea what is considered like a good book launch, what's considered as a book trending and doing well. So I went in completely blind to what would be considered a good, you know, sales numbers and things like that, or even a reception. So I set like a monthly goal. I was like, you know, for the first month, if I sell like 100 copies, that would be amazing. There's something special about 100 copies, you know, triple digits. That's cool. And I think I got that in pre-orders, and I was like, what? It was insane. It was insane to see. And I think it is a lot to do with because I was part of the community, and I had a lot of people who were interested in the book before, which was amazing. But the response has been absolutely incredible. I've had, I was a spotlight for the Fantasy Fellowship indie spotlight that they do. They do like a month where they all buy copies and then read it, and then they do one where they do like a book tour where they all share their thoughts and talk about it for a couple of weeks as they all post about it. It's just amazing to see these types of things, and that's one of the things I really like about being self-published, is there is this support in this industry for self-published authors, and there is these people who are really sharing it and really shouting from the rooftops about self-published books. And without people like that, self-published books just wouldn't be seen as much. So I'm so grateful to everybody who posts reviews, you know, talks about it, mentions it. It's just, it's amazing to see. I even had, this really blew my mind, Andy Pelliquin, who is the author of the Darkblade series. I've had him on my TBR for a while, and he's huge in the indie space. And he messaged me, and he was talking about reading my book, and then he read the book, and he really enjoyed it. I was like, there's something really nerve-wracking about other authors reading your book, because especially ones that are like super popular, you're like, oh no, is he gonna pick up at all like the mistakes or typos that are probably missed in it? But no, he was super nice and really enjoyed the book. And it's things like that, it's just, it blows my mind. I can't get over when someone connects to the characters like I have and the world and want to know what's happening next. I've had so many messages about book two, and it really is just the best feeling.
And talking about connecting to your characters, I'd like to go back to the editing part. I've heard you talk about the process and the way that you kind of shifted the POVs and the things that changed. And I think that when you think about the way you reworked your story, and as they always say, killing the darlings, and when you think about the relationship in the book, and the way that Anaya and Rai were basically two main focus points, and the way that it changed, how did that look like when you were in the middle of it? Did you maybe think that it wasn't going to work out? Did you think about scrapping the multiple POVs completely?
I was quite lucky. I caught it early in the process. I can't remember if I just started the first draft or if I was still outlining, but I was outlining it for Rai to be this main character. And the big difference in the plot that I made was a lot of his backstory was included in book one. But in the end, I ended up stripping some of that out to make it more of focus on Naya. And that was after reading that line in, I'm pretty sure it was Save the Cat, writes a novel. It was something under the lines of the main character should be the one that goes through the most in the book. And I was still, I can't remember if I was outlining, but I just looked at the overarching plot and I was like, Naya goes through way more than Rai does. It just makes more sense to have this focus on Naya and to have it be her story. And Rai is this sort of, he's still a main character, but more of a secondary character in this first book. And it means we can explore more of his backstory in book two. And yeah, so the main part of the switch was really just removing rather than adding things. It was just taking out a lot of this extra detail from Rai. And the one thing I really like that it's done is it's made Rai more of a mysterious character. You do definitely get bits of his past in this first book, to understand like his motivations and why he's doing what he's doing. But the way you learn about his backstory now in the first book is a lot more mysterious and from different points of views. So you kind of learn things by his own inner monologue and things he says to himself, but equally you also get a couple flashbacks in this book, one from a different point of view character, trying to keep the spoiler free, and you do get to see Rai at a different point in his life, and it does kind of like give you this idea of this rise and fall in his character and his past. And that again ties into his name. I have a naming convention in the book where the longer name you have, the higher social standing you have, and we have a couple bits of Rai's past where really early his name was Rai, and then we have a wee while ago flashback and his name was Akurai, and then in modern days called Rai. So you kind of see this rise and fall that's just kind of implied, but you don't get to see any details of why that is how it is. And I quite liked how that was more of a mystery, and you're like, what happened to him? Why is that like that? So I liked that element. That was another point that was just kind of lucky because I shifted the focus to Naya. I was like, oh okay, I like that this is now like this, and then I can focus on Rai's past in book two. And it just made more sense. As soon as I started laying it out, all these things kind of fell into place. I was like, this is what I wanted to do.
And did you, from the start, from the get-go, know that it's going to be a series, or did you figure it out later on?
I always planned it to be a trilogy. I really like the trilogy sort of setup, and I have, my outlining is very, very broad. I kind of have the main plot beats for a book, and then I kind of discovery right in between them. So a lot of the side characters and minor world building details are more discovery written and made up just to for the plot and the chapters that it makes sense for at the time. But I did have these main plot beats that just fit really well into a trilogy structure. I know how book two is going to end, and I knew how book three was going to end. And it's just like, okay, this is just perfect stopping points, and it just fits this three act structure really, really well. That I just always planned it to be a trilogy. But one of the things I did also want to do is I love bigger connected universes and things like that. if you watch the channel, you know, I talk about Brandon Sanderson all the time, but I know Stephen King does this as well, and tons of other authors. And I like this bigger connected universe and lots of different character stories in a grander story. So this trilogy is just the first arc in a bigger story that will then have future books tying into the world that you might see some cameos from these characters in as well. So it was planned to just be a trilogy, but I have left things to pull on in future books. But I did it so the trilogy feels complete. Because one of the things that Sanderson says that I completely ascribe to is this idea that a book ending should be an ending. A book should be a book. And it's the same way a trilogy should be a trilogy. I don't want people to feel like they're cheated and they finish the trilogy and they go, oh, but I really want to know about this. I don't want that. I want this to feel like a complete trilogy that you can just read the trilogy and that's fine. Or if you want, you can continue on to this series I'm going to write after the fact and just see all these threads that I'll pull on from the trilogy.
Yeah, I think that reads, even though we're still at the book, first book, but I think that some seeds that you planted really do lend themselves to thinking about the broader world and raising the scope of the story and the stakes. And for me, aside from the naming part, which is really interesting, I think that a lot of people do like the magic system, which is quite interesting. And when we think about those world-building elements, how did you approach that? Was it something that's also part of the discovery process, or did you kind of approach it in a separate way? Did you have the magic system thought out and then made it figure its way into the story, or it kind of came out together when you were walking with the characters, so to say?
Yeah, kind of a mix of both. A lot of the bigger scope things, like the magic system with the shades and the shadow magic and to the blood magic to a certain extent, I had all kind of in my head beforehand. And some of even the world building details I had in my head. My friends get weird messages from me all the time. I sent my friend a message. I actually forgot about this. It must have been a couple of years ago now. A message saying, imagine the sun was just like a giant eye. And like the moon was a giant eye. And this thing is turning the world. And that's like the sun and the moon. That's the weird text my friends get from me. But so I've had things like that. I've always kind of been in my head for a long period of time. And some of the, like, the sand turning black and solidifying at night. That, funnily enough, that came from a scene idea that was scrapped from book one. I didn't actually even write it. And it was this interesting idea that I might include in book two, but I'll just tell you anyway. And it was this idea that it also came with these bone trees, which is really thin trees where you can kind of break apart and they're, like, hollow. And I had this idea that Rai was being chased across the desert and it was getting darker and the sands were starting to solidify. And he buried himself under the sand, put this bone tree as like a straw just sticking through the sand, and then the sand solidifies around him. And then, you know, the people who are chasing him runs past and he's hidden below the sand. But then he's got to spend the entire night below the sand in this solidified black sand of the desert. And I was like, that's pretty horrific, but that would make a really cool scene. So that's how that idea first came up. And then I scrapped the scene, but the idea stuck. And once these things are in my head, you just start connecting them to other things, and then it start connect. This was before I started writing, and then it pulls into the story and is making these world building elements a part of this story, something as well that I really enjoy doing. Like, it's cool having just fancy world building, and there is a certain level of the rule of cool. If something's just cool, you can just include it because it's cool. We're reading fantasy, we want to see dragons, so that's fine. But I do also like when there's purpose to things that are happening or things that tie into the bigger story as well. So these ideas often come in bits and then I connect them together when I'm outlining and drawing them together. But a lot of the smaller details usually just come up while drafting. Like, one of the things that was a bit like the rule of cool as well was the merchants were crossing the desert with Rai. And I was writing the scene, I was thinking, right, these are people who are not used to the desert. They're going to be hot, they're going to be sweating. They don't really want to be here. They want to be in the shade. But they'll want to wash off in the mornings, but water's quite rare in the desert. How are we going to, you know, have them wash while they're traveling across huge expanses of desert? So then I had this idea of the Aya, which are these giant creatures that they ride across the desert. That's kind of a mix between a Highland cow and Appa from Avatar and the Last Airbender. I love how many people picked up on that influence, because I had someone who actually did some fan art of an eye and said, this is making me think of Appa from Avatar The Last Airbender. It's like, yep, that's exactly part of the inspiration. That meets a highly code. So I had that then lick Rai and to clean him, and it has like disinfectant properties, and it's like the merchants didn't like that very much. It's not, you know, it's a very Tarisian thing to do. It's kind of gross, but it made for this fun dynamic scene and adds this layer of world building and interest, and it's just, you know, fun. But things like that I usually just write in the drafting stage. That's just discovery written rather than pre-thought about.
And thinking about the desert, and as you said, we want to see dragons when we read fantasy, but like the most common settings are kind of European ones and like things that maybe go towards the Norse mythology, but somewhat of a rare thing in modern fantasy is your kind of setting. You do have like inspiration from the Egyptian mythology and stuff from the Middle East. And how did that come upon? Did you like, was this the story that could only exist in that type of world? How did that setting come upon?
To be honest, that kind of setting was pretty much where the story started. I didn't have the characters or the plot or anything like that, but I've always thought that ancient Egypt was really cool. Even like in school, we went, like, I don't know how this translates to the world, but primary three, so I must have been 6 or 7, and they did the topic then, and I thought it was like the coolest thing ever. Because it really is like one of the closest things to fantasy in real life that we can get, because it's this mystery and we don't know how they built the pyramids. They don't know this, that, and there's so much we don't know about it. There's, you know, it's just real life fantasy. So I just always thought that was really interesting and cool. So when I was thinking about creating a story, this sort of desert ancient Egyptian influence was kind of where it started, because I thought that that would just be a really interesting base and something that, like you said, you don't see that often, which I think is a shame, and I hope that we really see more things like that. There is now more than there was, but I would like to see more with that type of setting.
Yeah, and that's interesting when you think about the school and everything we've done as kids, and my mind went back to, I had this book which was about ancient Egypt, and they had those little 3D glasses, the cardboard ones, the old school ones, and you had like some elements in the book that were 3D like popping out. And it truly was like reading like a piece of fiction, and that's something that maybe in that time period, maybe it was a little bit more present in a broader sense, like the Mummy movies and stuff like that. Yeah. But you know, but I think that we've more and more gravitated towards the European darker fantasy stuff, and it's interesting that like in the more recent years, maybe like the Dune resurgence is a partially something like desert set, but is still the mythology isn't there, and I think that's something that's really inspirational and a thing that can yield a lot more stuff. And I had a discussion with one of my previous guests, who's also talked about creating his own creatures and populating the world and stuff like that, and we've discussed about how some of the things in the fantasy have become a bit like formulaic. Of course, there's a ton of great authors, not to say that we're in a crisis or something like that, but like some people are maybe, they may be afraid to explore some more out there stuff and things that aren't exactly on trend. Of course, when you think about, especially when you're self-published, you do want to think about the market and the cover that we talked about and stuff like that. But I think that it's like a thin line where you're like catering to an audience and exploring things that you want to explore. So I think that's something that's really interesting to think about, how you've managed to pull some things that fans recognize, like the thing from the Avatar, but still make it your own. And did you have like some maybe subconscious things that seeped into your work when you think about like things that you read and watched that you recognized and were like, oh, that's where did that thing come from?
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree. I think a lot of there's always going to be a place for classic fantasy. I think we're at the point now where there's so many books coming out, so many new authors and stuff, that we're always going to get a mix of everything, which I think is great. I love to see the variety in the genre. And I think, especially with the influx of self-published books, these, you know, more creative ideas. It sounds harsh, but you can take riskier ideas with self-publishing because you don't have to get loads of people to say, yes, okay, we think that will sell. You can get these more off the wall, crazy ideas with self-publishing that is, you will hopefully find more of these like unique new creatures, new flora and fauna. That was one of the things that I really wanted to do, because it's just something that I really like in fantasy. I think I agree that I love elves and dwarves and dragons. You just can't go wrong with them.
Of course.
But sometimes you do. It's nice to have a variety. I like reading about new creatures and places and things that are just completely unique. And Sanderson was one of the things that really opened my eyes to this. He does a lot with the world building and the magic systems that you don't see in other places. And it's just, I like that layer of newness. It's partly why I think a lot of people get into fantasy, because it is so new. It's kind of like traveling. You're discovering new cultures, new places, things that you didn't know existed, and new ways of life that you didn't know could happen. And I really like having that layer of ability to create new things. The only thing that's really difficult is trying to describe new creatures and animals is really tough, because I really want to compare them. It's like, oh, it's like a mishmash of this and this. And I was like, that means this and this has to exist in the world. I can't say it's like this and this. So trying to describe them is quite tough. And I do think that sticking to the more classical elements like elves and dragons, the things that people know, is smarter marketing wise. I think people revolve around these things. It's like, oh, got dragons? I mean, I'm the same. If it's got dragons, I'm sold. So I do think that, like, from a marketing standpoint, it makes complete sense. And I don't think everyone goes into it thinking that. I do think that, you know, a lot of people just like writing about dragons and elves, which makes complete sense. But I do think we see a lot of it because loads of people think, dragons, I'm going to read that. So I can see both sides of the coin, and I'm glad that we get both, especially with self-publishing and this, for more variety in authors and just more stuff and things.
And when you think about like putting those things together, how it would look in real life, do you think like something of a adaptation, more of a, let's say, could you imagine it being more of a game type of adaptation if it was to happen, or more of a TV or movies kind of thing? Can you see like the world that you've built translating or lending itself more to creating a video game environment, or more of a movie or even an animated show kind of feeling?
Probably a TV show. I think it would probably adapt to best. I'm kind of in the same boat as Sanderson in the fact that because there is so much different world building and things, it could also work as an animated film, because it's a lot, you can draw bizarre things and you don't need to create them with computers, because CG is getting really good, but animation is really cool as well. With the video games, I do think you need a specific type of story. I'm not sure how certain elements would translate to like a game. I know a lot of like the lit RPGs are doing really well at the moment, and a lot of them use a lot of game mechanics, and I love that storytelling and kind of the blend between video games and novels. But yeah, I think mine would probably work best as a TV show.
And speaking of TV shows, you've done a bit of commenting on your channel. You've talked about The Last of Us, and you've done a bit crossovers with other types of media. Is it something that you've been looking to explore more, or is it something like you've decided not to include on your channel?
It's quite tough, because I think algorithmically you're supposed to niche down. You're supposed to really pick something out and, like, you know, focus on that. If I'm talking about fantasy books, people are there for fantasy books, and the algorithm promotes it to people who read fantasy books. But I did a poll on my Instagram, because on my Instagram I'm a lot more free with what I share on my story. I like post music stuff, I post games I'm playing, TV shows I'm watching, and it's just a lot more laid back. So I did post a poll just out of interest to see how many people played games as well as read, and I was blown away by how much crossover there is. I thought it was going to be fairly slim, but most people played games as well. And I do think there is a huge crossover in gaming and reading and movies as well. It's just different ways to consume stories, and I would love to dip into more, but it doesn't make a lot of sense algorithmically, and I'm not sure how much of interest there would be on making videos on it. I'm always interested, and I'm always playing more games and watching loads of TV shows and things, but I never know how much people actually want to see that in video format. I'm always up for talking about it and sharing thoughts and things, but for making soul videos and things like that, I probably would. Is something I, if you go on my channel, I do try lots of different types of videos. So if I find a new way to talk about TV show and films or games, then I would definitely put up just to see, gauge interest and see if people were interested in it, because it is something I'm interested in. But I think for the most part, it'll probably just be fantasy books.
Yeah, but for me, what was interesting to see, like, you did a video talking about books that could be games, and I think that that also ties into my previous question, but I think that's also a great way to think about it. I think those things do coexist, and yeah, I got the algorithm thing and everything that's kind of a technical standpoint for everybody in the space, but I think that's also something that gives you like more of a perspective on some things when you consume different media, when you branch out into games, movies, not necessarily making reviews, but like just engaging with the media and talking to people about it. I think that also helps with creating your work, and I think that also could be like that resonates in your work. And I think that maybe like things that you've done previously, we mentioned filmmaking, photography, and even music. We see those amazing guitars behind you. do tie in into atmosphere of it all? Do you think about like when you set up a scene? Do you think about sound aspects of it or the visual aspects of it? Even though you're not exactly making a screenplay, but how does that pan out when you write?
Oh yeah, completely. I'm very visual in the way I write. I come to action sequences and I'm like, yeah, okay. I start playing like Two Steps from Hell, blasting this, you know, orchestra music, getting the feeling of you know, the action scene, and then get into it, and very visual, because that's how I imagine how I would shoot it is how I normally try to write it, if that makes sense. So I'm definitely very visual in the way that I then write, and also I do listen to a lot of music while I'm writing, which, yeah, I couldn't write without music. I have done, and sometimes write for a little bit, but for the most part, it's to music. But I do think there's a huge crossover between mediums and things you can learn from game design that translates to storytelling. I think this is something, again, I'm going to sound like a fanboy by mentioning him again, but something that Sanderson does really well is this idea that's in game development where you show something completely stripped back and simple, just so you can then later on show it in a more complex manner. And I think it's a great way to show off some of these more complicated world building ideas. Like in a Zelda dungeon, you might walk into a room and there's a huge lip at the top that gets into the next room, and the only thing that's actually in the room is this huge rock blocking a pipe. So you have to obviously destroy the block, and then the water goes up, and then you can get through. It's very simple. There's nothing else there in the room. It's the only thing you could do. And then you move on into the next room, and suddenly there's tons of pipes at different levels, and you think, right, okay, well, I know from the first room I need to blow them up, and then it'll bring the water level up, and that'll get me up, you know, over and out. And this idea of having this more, you know, simplified version of something at the start, then to expand on it later, or show the same simple concepts, but perhaps more in a more complicated overarching manner, is something that I think Sanderson does really well, and is a really good way to get across some more complex world building ideas. So pulling together parts from games, films, TV shows, and how they do it in that medium, there's certain structural things or things that they can do. You can learn from all of those. So yeah, I completely agree. There's so much to learn from stories across all mediums, definitely.
And thinking about the algorithm stuff, back to it, when you discuss books and stories from other authors, especially in the space, how does that feel when you think about, like, as you said, when some of the people with more of an audience pick up your book, you're kind of anxious of your reactions, but even though a lot of people are supportive, what do you think about, like, if you picked up a book from a fellow author who's in the space and you had a negative negative reaction to it, how would that translate? Of course, not necessarily something you'd like to pick apart and like give it zero stars, but how do you approach critiquing fellow authors now that you are a published author and somebody who's planning on being in the space for a long time, hopefully?
Yeah, for sure. It does make things more complicated when you're friends with them, or they sent you the book even. I found this when I was just reviewing before I'd published my book. If they send you a book, you do feel a certain, you know, pressure to, you don't want, if you didn't enjoy it, you don't want to drag it through the mud and say, I hated it, it was rubbish. I'm quite lucky that I've not actually come across one that I've really hated that I've been sent. I've enjoyed pretty much every book I've been sent. I'm quite lucky in that way, or that usually I'm very picky what books I take from authors, and that's the very reason, is that I don't want to take on books that I don't think I'm going to enjoy. If I read the premise or, you know, synopsis of it and I think, wow, that sounds right up my street, that's the only way I'm going to probably pick it up. And even then, I get quite a lot of review requests and things like that, that it's hard to take on even the ones that I am interested in. But if I do pick up a book that I'm not, you know, it's not my favorite book, but there's still a lot I enjoyed about it, I make it very clear that these are things I would enjoy. These are things that didn't necessarily work for me. And I would hope that people who review my book feel the same. I wouldn't, you know, if one of my friends read the book and said, I like this, but I didn't really like this, that, and the next thing, that's completely fine with me. There's so many books out there and you're not going to like every single one. So it wouldn't bother me if I got a fairly negative review. It would be different if they said, one star, this is terrible, I burned it after I read it. That would be a different story. There is, you know, there's a way of doing it. But I do also want to be honest to people. I probably wouldn't include it in a video or make a sole video on it. But I would still, if people asked about it or I put in a wrap-up or something like that, I would just say, these are things I like, these are things that didn't necessarily work for me. But I also think sometimes the things that didn't work for you are quite often things that work for a lot of people, a lot of other people. I've seen negative reviews that the replies have been, not in my book, but there was like one that was like, this is really dark. And mine's quite dark, but not super, super dark. But this book had a, you know, this is really dark, I hate this, that, and the next thing. These are really messed up topics, and the top comment was something like, great, this sounds fantastic, I'm going to go buy this right now. So I do think that even negative reviews just helps the book find the right reader. So I do just try and be honest but respectful, and I think other authors would be the same. I've not seen anyone really hate on a book they didn't enjoy. I think most people are pretty respectful and nice in the community.
Yeah, I think that also sounds like a good approach. I mean, people do appreciate the honest feedback, even though, as you said, you won't drag it through the mud. Like, it's better that than to people think, okay, this is amazing, and then they come out disappointed. But there's also another thing that comes to mind. I'm not sure who said it, but it was like, when I'm down on my confidence and I can't get myself to writing, I pick out a book of one of my favorite authors, look up the reviews and sort them by like descending. I put the one stars yeah. up and read how people treat their books, and that gets me in the mood.
Yeah, it's true. If you search up your favorite book and look at the one star reviews and people really ripping into it, it just shows you, you know, loads of people have weird taste. They're very unique, different tastes. So
yeah, but it's important that we have those spaces to discuss them. And you recently also talked about a book festival you went on your channel. And even though you couldn't quite record the debate, I think that was really interesting. I'd like to touch a bit upon that. How many like conferences and things like that have you visited in the past? What do you think about those events?
Yeah, I've actually really not been to very many. I used to, it was the Edinburgh Book Festival, and I'm quite close to Edinburgh, so it's very accessible for me. So whenever it comes, that sometimes, like, I've only really got back into reading since 2020, and a lot of that, it was, you know, shut down and things like that. But I managed to get a spot for this talk this year, and it was really interesting because I went on, I looked for authors I know, and I left it pretty late. So I missed out on a lot of the shows that might have piqued my interest, or, you know, I didn't really get the chance to look through all of the different shows. It was just, I'll look for this authors I recognize and I'll go to their show and try and find one that still has tickets available. So next year, I'm going to be more in the ball and check early. But I've not really been to very many. And one thing I really want to do is to go to more conventions. I was on the fence earlier in the year about going to FantasyCon this year, which is in Birmingham in September past, and I ended up not going. And the amount of people who went, and it looked like it was such a great time, I was like, this was a mistake, I should have bought tickets. It's just, so I do think that that's something I want to do more of in the future, especially next year. I think is going to be a big convention year for me, where I'm going to go to more of these more in-life events and such. I think that would be really fun, because they do look like great fun. I think it's a great way to meet the people that you've been talking to through the community anyway, so definitely something I want to do more of.
And you've also talked about, I think that ties into talking about like signing your books and shipping out signed copies. I think that's also a great way to maybe bridge that gap in a way, because I know a lot of authors talk about, I also had on previously a fellow Serbian author who's also like having some issues with shipping out signed copies. And I think that's kind of a thing that's... if you're not in the US, I think that can be an issue, but I think that kind of events and things that maybe people do go out from all over the world, maybe that can be kind of a stepping stone towards maybe organizing something bigger and getting to a lot of your fans.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't realize how many people would be interested in signed copies. It was not something I thought about for launch or anything like that, and I got so many messages about it, and I was like scrambling to figure out how to do it. And it's not easy to do, because the downside is I then have to buy the copies from the printer and then sell them all and ship them myself. But shipping can be really expensive. It's usually fine in the UK, but out with the UK it can get really expensive, and I just feel really guilty charging these prices. I don't like charging these ridiculous prices. That's part of the reasons why I went with the publisher, well, distributor that I went with, because they have printers all around the world, which makes it very accessible rather than just the Amazon one. So it's definitely something that I was looking into, and I ended up sorting out book plates. So it's like signed stickers basically that you can then sign and then stick in the book. And I sent out a ton of signed copies to especially the Fantasy Fellowship Indie Spotlight. They all ordered, well, not all of them, but the ones who were opted in to join the read-along all got like signed copies and things like that. But it is a really difficult thing to manage as a self-published indie author, and not something that I don't think most people, well, I didn't think about it until very late in the game, and I was like, oh no, I need to fix this. So yeah, the events and things like that would make it a lot easier. And I think having these book plates, because then people can buy them in different countries and then you can ship them to them, but even doing that can be quite difficult as well. There's just so much logistically behind the scenes that you don't think about until it hits you in the face and you think, okay, that needs sorted. I need to do something. So I'm quite lucky that I'm actually, you can now buy signed copies, signed book plate copies on Broken Binding. So I'm glad to say that they have signed book plate copies. I sent them a big couple sheets of signed book plates so they can then buy in the books for orders, stick them in, and then ship them off from there, which makes it a lot easier, because it just doesn't mean that I'm sending packaging up and sending these books out all the time. And is finding ways to sell them, like, I'm not sure how I design a shop. There's so much to it. It's so complicated. There's probably people who have done it and know better than me, but yeah, I think conventions and things are probably quite good for signing copies and things like that, definitely.
And I think that the signed plates is really an interesting solution to that. I mean, at least a quick fix, because I honestly haven't seen it before you talked about it. That's really a great way to deal with that. And also that also raises the question about like how many people do want signed copies, and even more like you're part of the Kindle Unlimited program, and even though ebooks are large, especially in the self-publishing space, but still it's really interesting seeing how many people do care about physical copies, and not just like signed special editions, things like that, but just usual general paperbacks, hardbacks. And for me, it's really exciting to see that it's something that's really still so strong after all these years, and the way that technology is basically swallowed other industries, like even physical games are increasingly more rare, and like a lot of people don't care that much as they used to, apart from like huge collectors. But people are opting for, even you have game consoles that even don't have the CD reader. So I think that's like the way it's moving, and talking about music as well, the streaming. And I think that the books have maybe withstood the test the most out of all media, and that's really interesting to me.
Or the dreaded code in the box when you buy a game and they open up, it's just a code in a box. Like, it's not why I bought the game. But yeah, it definitely seems to be that most things are going digitally. I think most of the casual audience perhaps still revolve around more digital copies, like ebooks and things like that. I don't know how much of the wider sphere is sticking to physical. I do think that social media and the communities that are building there, lots of people sharing books, posting pictures of books, talking about the books and holding the books up and things, has really helped with that sort of thing. I think a lot of people do like the experience of reading with a book, and you can get all the added extras, like especially with special editions with, you know, interior illustrations and things that you wouldn't get in the ebook or even online. Most of them are not online. So I do think that there will certainly, for now, it's doing really, really well. I don't know if like in 50 years time it'll all go digital, but I think you're right. It's definitely lasting a lot longer than other industries, which is really happy to see, because I love having physical copies of books.
For sure. And also a lot of times the topic that comes up along with that is the attention span, and people like not having time to read. But for me, seeing this space and the authors such as yourself, I think that's kind of a, let's say, not the delusional thinking, but for me it's something of a mistake to think that people aren't interesting as much. I think that contrary, especially with the pandemic that we saw, and I think that people are reading a lot of books, and I think that's something of a weird narrative that you can hear in a lot of places, that people just don't have the time. And for me, like, on one hand you have a lot of new books coming, series, people are mostly interested in series, reading like books upon books from the same authors, and even like movies being even longer on average than they were like 10, 15, 20 years ago. And for me, that's kind of an interesting contrast of people constantly talking about, oh, it's the social media, people don't have time for anything. And on the other hand, you have this community that's like, people just can't get enough.
I completely agree,
The thing that I also want to get a bit back to is the art. We've talked about the cover art a bit, but also like thinking about the interior of the books and illustrations. Have you thought about like doing later on some editions that would contain more artwork? How do you approach that? Do you think about something like that in the future?
Oh yeah, I'd love like a special edition with more illustration artwork. It's really expensive to get commissioned and things like that. But yeah, I love books with art inside it. I definitely think it'd be really cool, especially with the type of book where you have unique creatures and places and things rather than, you know, your creatures that you know. It'd be really interesting to see these visualized, which is why it blew my mind that, you know, some people had done fan art for the book. It was so exciting to see some of these ideas that were just, you know, words then imagined as illustrations. So I would love to do that. It's definitely something I have on the not on the horizon, but something that I'm thinking about. I do want to focus on the writing and getting the trilogy done, so I don't think there'll be anything before the trilogy is done. Perhaps afterwards I'll do some nice additions, but we'll have to wait and see. Depends if there's interest in it and things like that. But yeah, it's definitely something I would be interested in doing, because I love interior artwork.
Talking about the trilogy, how's the second book coming? You've done some updates, you have your writing vlogs on the channel, and how's the process different from writing the first one? What have you applied from work with your editor, and how's it shaping up? Do you see it like maybe coming out soonish, or how's it looking?
Yeah, the second book's come along well. It's come along quite well. I think when I was writing the first book, I didn't have YouTube channel, so it's kind of split my time a wee bit. So the act of actually writing, I have less time to do writing if I'm going to keep up with reading and making videos as well. So it is taking a wee bit longer than I was hoping. I'm still pretty much on target for where I wanted. It'll probably be late summer, fall of next year would be my guess. Very vague wasted area there, but that's kind of the thought, is that I'm going to aim for that. I do think the book's going to be a little bit longer than the first book as well, which changes things. But I think after learning so much from the first book, I definitely seem to be writing cleaner first draft, which is nice, because my first draft for the first book was horrific and needed to not be seen by anyone ever. So the first drafts are just meant to be done, and I don't put a lot of pressure on making it, you know, readable and nice. But I definitely feel like this is a lot neater because I've learned so much from writing the first book. Because the first book was under very different circumstances, my writing process has changed a lot with the second book, just when I'm writing things like that with the channel and everything as well. One thing that I've started doing that I really, really like is this thing called the Pomodoro technique. It's something that I learned about in high school, but I'm not doing that since it's not going to help. That's ridiculous. It's this idea to have this focus, like 25 minutes of work and then this 5 minute break. And then there's 25 minutes of work. And I was like, no, I can sit and write. You know, for most of the first book, I just sat and wrote for 3 or 4 hours or whatever in a row. And that was just kind of, you know, it was not 3 or 4 hours of work, but it was 3 or 4 hours of work. And it just worked. But now with time being a little tighter and I've not got the same focus because I'm more split between lots of different things, I've found this to be really useful. It was something that... I don't know if I'm going to pronounce his name wrong. Zhao, who wrote Seeds of War, he said it in an interview, and he said he'd heard it from a bunch of other indie authors. And I was like, well, if all these authors are doing it, right, I need to at least try it. So I tried it, and I was so surprised at how much words I got down in that amount of time. And it sounds silly, but I don't know if it's just because there must be science behind it, probably. But for me, I think it's just, you know, I can manage 25 minutes of writing. If I'm sitting down to write, when I was writing book one, it was right. I'm going to sit down, we're going to write. And it's for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, you put it off because you're like, this is going to be for hours and hours. Let's do this first or let's do that. Whereas I can sit down and do 25 minutes. I could, you know, do that right now and that would be fine. 25 minutes just seems like a manageable time. And I think that's all it takes, is to really get into it. And then you do that, you take a 5 minute break and then you keep doing it and then you get into the mindset and it just rolls a lot easier. So it's definitely just taking down some walls of getting into writing that I really like, so it's definitely something I'll probably keep doing for this book too.
Yeah, I think that's something that you hear from a lot of authors, and for me it's really interesting that that we can see that a lot of people have the basically the same issue, like putting off work and okay, this is taking too much, or I can do it this way. But when you're just like maybe cheat your brain into thinking like, this isn't a lot, we can do this, and it adds up. And it's really interesting that when you plan it that way, it works. So it's interesting hearing that from you as well. And as you said, the first draft isn't meant to be seen by anyone, but no, you also mentioned saying some ideas to your friends and stuff like that. Do you share your work with them after the first draft? Are they your better readers? Do you have better readers, and how does that work for you, who you send your work to?
Yeah, so no, not really. A lot of the reasons why I made the Instagram account was because a lot of my friends don't read the same types of books I do, or some of them don't really read much at all. So it was just finding people, like-minded people, so I could chat to with about the books I'm reading. So I do occasionally send them the bizarre ideas. Like the eye thing is like, what about this? This would be cool, wouldn't it? Because my friend is really into film, so he's still into storytelling and things like that. So I'm not sure he'd be into reading huge drafts of things and things like that. I did try and bully him into it, but he wasn't particularly receptive. But sharing like bizarre story ideas and things like that, you definitely talk up to him a lot about that sort of thing. As for beta reading, it's really difficult to find beta readers for your first book, when ironically it's probably the most useful because you'll learn so much from the act. I did have a couple of people I know read it as a beta reader before it was off to the editor and things like that. But it's something I want to do more of with the second book. That's partly why I pushed it's not exactly like a year between book one and book two, is because I want a longer time to have run by beta readers and get feedback from them before I give it to my editor. And then the other thing I want is a longer run up between the book being finished and release to give ARC readers more of a chance. I did kind of feel like I'd been talking about this book for so long that I wanted to get out there, and I was happy with it and it was done. But, you know, you can always do another draft of it. You can always do this. So you need to set a deadline. But I do want to have a longer start to finish, because I think there will be more. The upside to writing like a sequel is the releases are very different. How you approach it is very different, because they're with a debut, no one's really read your work before. There isn't the same level of hype, or some, there's still hype. I'm not saying, you know, that there's not going to be hype around a debut book. Of course there is, but I do think with the second book, people have read the first book. People are excited for the second book. And I think by having this longer lead up and giving readers a chance to catch up, and, you know, some of them I've heard that want to reread book one, which is mind blowing, but they wouldn't do that and then read book two. And I've had others that are interested in, you know, ARC reading book two and things like that. I think having that longer window is just going to be really good for the book.
And do you think that, like, when we see some even longer series from authors and people just, like, being interested in seeing more, and we're also seeing stories about, like, authors who aren't maybe finishing the stories in time that they maybe said they would, and especially with some more famous authors, but generally in the space there are a lot of people who maybe have the pressure of being on, like, strict deadlines. Do you think that can impact your writing? How, what's your, like, maybe approach to knowing that, okay, I'm done with this, there is always some more drafting to be done, nothing's ever perfect, but what's your take on that? Like, when will you know that the second book is ready?
Yeah, there's definitely more of a pressure after the debut book, because debut book, no one's waiting unless you set a deadline, but most people wait until it's ready and then set a deadline. But with a sequel, people, I've already had messages saying, you know, I'd love to pick up book one. When's book two going to come out? It's not been written yet. And there is a certain consistency, particularly if you want to make this a career, or you want, you know, your books to do well. It's a bit like BookTube as well. There is a certain level of consistency people expect from these sorts of things. And I think for the most part, people are really respectful. But yeah, there's definitely more pressure with sequels and getting them out quite quickly. I personally, I ascribe to, like, the book will be out when it's done. I don't want to ever rush a book out. I would much rather people be annoyed that it's a couple months late or 6 months late than put out a product that I'm not happy with. So I'm definitely in more of the publish it when it's ready camp, but like I said, there is a certain level of consistency that really is needed to keep people and readers in the thoughts of your book, if that makes sense. Not really, but you know what I mean. Yeah. To keep in the head of readers. That's what I mean.
Yeah, of course. And I like the sentiment that you mentioned in one of your videos about, like, even though some series from some authors aren't finished yet and maybe they won't be ever, it's still great to be in that world. And for me, that ties in well with what you said about your book, that, like, you want to have finished books that, okay, maybe they do promise that something else coming up, but it's not something that's relying solely on being the trailer for the next thing. And for me, that's really good, because I think that that's something that's kind of an annoying trend in storytelling in general, especially in movies, that everything is a setup for something that's coming. And not to say that it's bad that you have a trilogy planned, but when you approach it like, this is the story I want to tell, opposed to like, this is just like a thing that I need to keep pedaling to get to the next one. And for me, that's something that also gives me the impression of care for your story, opposed to something that's just purely a product.
Yeah, no, yeah, I completely agree. There is, I mean, loads of people say this about Marvel, especially with some of the later stuff, is they are not all the time. I do actually like Marvel. I don't want it to come across I don't like Marvel, but a lot of them those types of films, people do complain a lot because it just feels like they're, you know, continuing on with the same thing, and it is all just like an interconnected thing, and it is just trying to move on to the next thing. And the amount of output they have, I mean, we went through a stage, it was just like 3-4 Marvel films a year or something insane like that. There was so many, and I think that there is a certain level of quality that you need to have, and that really needs to be the main focus. And having a book as a book, a lot of where I've not really read much where it's not like this, but a book should be an interconnected thing. This should be an experience within itself. It shouldn't just, you know, finish and make it, well, it should make you want to pick up the next one, but it shouldn't be a requirement for the enjoyment of that product. And that is something that's quite difficult to do with these more grander scale stories that, you know, span loads of books. I'm sure it's really difficult. You hear people talk about like the middle book syndrome and things like that, and it is something that I have put a lot of thought into trying to avoid. And it's just making each book their own thing, their own arcs, and making things finish. So you need to have an overarching, you know, for the trilogy, but there needs to be arcs within that as well to make it feel complete when you finish a book. So it's definitely something I've thought about, and yeah, you're right, it's definitely vitally important, I think.
And before I let you go, I think that I would like to hear, when we're talking about the future of your series and your world, what's the thing that you're most excited about it, and what would be something that maybe we as readers could be most excited about?
I'm really excited about some of the character arcs I have coming up. Some of the things that I think will be completely unexpected, and things might even be without this trilogy. There's just this huge scale story that I'm planning and setting the seeds for. I'm really excited for people getting to the much later books and thinking, that's like that thing in book one. I like this idea that it's just connected over such a long period of time. Again, not just a loose thread, but just this thing that's connected to this other thing that is fine and it makes sense, or this foreshadowing that is so obvious when you know the answer. And I've had things in book one that I'm like, is that too obvious? But I've not heard anyone pick up on it, and it's like, So I think definitely resolving some of these bigger arcs is something that I'm super excited for.
That sounds awesome, and I'm really looking forward to the rest of the series and the other work that you put out, and I'm wishing you all the success with it, as well as with your channel. Thank you for coming on to Storyline Sessions, and I'm hoping to connect again in the future.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was great fun. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of Storyline Sessions. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find Andrew on YouTube and Instagram. I'll put the links below the like button. If you're interested in creative writing and storytelling of any kind, keep following Storyline Sessions, both here and on Instagram. There's a new episode coming your way every Thursday. This podcast is recorded using Riverside FM. It's a tool that I highly recommend. It allows you to record remote conversations locally. That means that the internet connection doesn't impact the quality of your recording no matter where you are. It offers other useful features for creating different types of content with people across the world. If you'd like to try it out, use the link in the description. That helps me with a commission without any additional cost to you. My name is Marko Bogdanović, and I'll see you next week. Keep creating stories.